Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing. On this edition, the family whose company was at the heart of the US opioid crisis see their $6 billion deal to avoid future legal action set aside by the Supreme Court. Also, Korea's Webtoons launch on the share market in New York. We'll hear from their chief financial officer. Ahead of the first US TV presidential debate, what do Americans want to hear from their candidates on the economy? Plus claims the company making iPhones in India is discriminating against women. Let's start with the Sackler family, which in the US are widely blamed for much of the opioid crisis there, which kills tens of thousands of Americans through overdoses each year. The family owned and operated Purdue Pharma, the OxyContin maker, for decades. And when the company was wound up, the Sacklers agreed to pay $6 billion towards a wider settlement in exchange for sweeping protections against civil claims related to the addictive opioid. Well, now the Supreme Court has struck down the part of that deal that shielded family members from future legal action. Well, I asked our reporter in New York, Neda Tofik, what the ruling means.
Essentially, what the Supreme Court has done is blocked this multi-billion dollar settlement that was reached as a result of Purdue Pharma reorganizing under bankruptcy, and the Sackler family, which is a third party, of course, which owns the company, agreeing to pay $6 billion as part of that to the victims, states, local governments, families who lost loved ones to addiction, in order to try to kind of settle the matter. Because, of course, Purdue Pharma, the maker of the painkiller OxyContin, has really been blamed for kind of fueling the public health crisis. But now the Supreme Court decision puts a stop to that settlement and really takes it back to the start.
So does this mean that we're going to see lots of individual lawsuits against members of the Sackler family personally in a result and possibly, I suppose, costing them billions of dollars?
Well, look, essentially, we have gotten a lot of reaction to this decision. When you see what Purdue Pharma has said, they say that they're going to immediately reach back out to the same creditors and try to renew a pursuit of a resolution. Ultimately, the Sackler family is separate from the company. They haven't declared bankruptcy. Of course, they tried in this deal to kind of shield themselves from any civil lawsuits that might come up in the future in exchange for giving that $6 billion to the states and individuals. They say in a statement that they are hopeful that they can still reach a resolution that provides resources to help combat the epidemic, and to also give billions of dollars to people and communities. So I think this is the big question mark. You know, one of the victims' family members has spoken to the BBC. She said, look, this was never a perfect plan, but it was something that was agreed upon by 95% of the creditors, and that they are concerned that it is going to be a legal complete nightmare now.
I can't even see the future of how this will play out, because it will be a run to the courthouse to see who's going to get the most money. The victims will get nothing. It's going to be a complete nightmare. Putting the Sacklers in jail is not going to save lives. It might make people feel happy that they got their due diligence. To me, it's just so important that this $6 billion get out there, get out into the communities who are all doing such good work now with the $50 million that they've gotten so far, and we can put a stop to this epidemic once and for all.
And we shouldn't forget, Neda, that the core of this is an open, still running sore in the US, where people, tens of thousands every year, are dying from opioid overdoses, which many trace directly, at least in part, to this company.
Oh, absolutely. Look, when you ask kind of experts what responsibility Purdue Pharma had and the Sackler family had in the explosion of the opioid epidemic, some say they had the lion's share of responsibility. Look, they pleaded guilty to essentially mismarketing OxyContin, which is highly addictive, as a painkiller that wasn't addictive. But we know that many people who went on to be addicted to heroin, a lot of them started on painkillers, whether it was from injury or just getting into it in other ways. But it is a highly addictive substance, opioids in general. And OxyContin and the way it was marketed certainly kind of kicked off their doctors prescribing it more regularly and kind of the public not seeing them as big of a threat in terms of addiction as people are starting to understand and learn more now. So certainly Purdue Pharma has been cited again and again as beginning the trend that we saw. And if you look at the kind of numbers, as you say, how many people have died, the marketing of OxyContin really kicked off in 1996. And from 1999 to 2019, more than 240,000 people in the United States died from prescription opioid overdoses.
Neda Torfik speaking to me there from New York. Now, do you know what a webtoon is? Well, it's a web comic that you can read on your screen, and they come mostly from South Korea, where they have millions of followers around the world. The format, which builds on a rich history of visual storytelling in Korea, has gained popularity globally following the success of K-pop, K-dramas, and other Korean cultural exports. Well, the major Korean company doing webtoons, Webtoon Entertainment, has just launched on the Nasdaq Stock Exchange in New York. The stock opened at $21.30, giving the company a valuation of $2.71 billion. Well, I spoke to David Lee, the Chief Financial Officer and Chief Operating Officer for Webtoon Entertainment, and he told me how the launch had gone.
Today, the stories that we generate from our own ecosystem of creators, you know, we have 24 million creators. The majority of those stories are consumed by users who are outside of our origin in Asia. You know, 72% of our 170 million monthly active users are here in the US, in France, in Latin America, et cetera. And so for us to be able to attract the highest level of capital markets investors listed on NASDAQ with great investors like BlackRock, who is on the cover as our anchor in the S1, it gives us confidence that we will have strong support for the global opportunity that we're pursuing. I think that our mission is to one day be the preeminent source of all stories, independent of what format they may come in, because ours is a focused business. It's focused on digital storytelling with a global user base and a global set of creators.
Well, those creators, David, I guess are at the core of it, as you say. Are they going to get some of the gravy that's coming from this? There's a big investment. Is that going to filter down to the people who actually they're creating this stuff?
Well, what's unique about our business model is over the last 6 years, we've provided our creators $2.8 billion.
So just to make that clear, that the money will come through to them. They will not be exploited, because often in creative areas, I mean, this happens across multiple media, it's the people who created who get the least reward. You're saying that isn't going to be the case here?
Absolutely not. In fact, this model allows folks who never had a chance to be a professional creator to publish globally. And every dollar of revenue we receive at the episode level, at the content level, we have a predetermined amount of revenue share. And it's true when you are a more modest creator, perhaps you're only in a couple of countries, or with what we call franchise stars. We agree upfront to ensure that we fair share before we even know how big the total pie is to be shared, because we like to enable mutual success.
Okay, take me inside your business model, because I've looked at Webtoons on the web. They're mostly free. Where does the money come from? How does it work?
Take our typical consumer here in the US. Let's call her Maddie. Maddie is under the age of 25. She surfs for free, as you say. And this universe of content is ever updating every week from across the globe and has unexpected content that she may not be able to discover anywhere else. In fact, our target consumer says, 77% of them say, in North America, they simply can't get the content they enjoy here on our program than anywhere else. And 97% say what they do enjoy is more fun than Roblox, Netflix, and TikTok. And when our target has, at their own patience and time, picked a story they like, they read it for snackable 5 to 10 minutes per episode. And when they want to see the next one that's yet to be written, that's going to drop in a week, they on average spend 15 to 70 cents only just to see it when anybody else can see it just in time. Well, we know that over a 3-year period that our consumers, once they start reading, once they discover their own story they love, they read more. They read and spend 2.5 and 2.6 times respectively more over a 3-year period without us pushing them, monetizing them. It's a remarkable model because it relies upon the evergreen continual flow of new content.
And it doesn't depend on sponsorship, on advertising, on pop-ups, on the kind of things that so many other platforms use?
Well, today, for example, of the $1.3 billion US of our trailing 12-month revenue, something like 10 or 11% is from advertising. But what's remarkable is the advertising we focus on actually results in deeper engagement by the consumer. You know, when our target's already 5 episodes deep into a great story that she loves, to show her a 30-second ad that may be even related to her story in an ad that allows her to read the next episode for free. Well, once she finishes that story, she has even more confidence that she's going to find the next one, because every week there's a new source of new stories across almost all genres.
What's the next area of expansion then, David? You tell me how it works now. Where are you going next?
Well, the whole business is powered by data and AI, meaning in addition to being an ecosystem that generates its own hits, I don't make judgment. I let the data tell us. And we have all these tools, these AI tools to enhance human creativity. Where it goes next is we've powered 100 examples of crossover hits. The number one global hit on Netflix today is called The 8 Show. It came from 2 of our Webtoon stories. I think the future will bring us providing a flow of new and fresh stories to anyone that needs them, and let them pay for their production and the continuous need to maintain distribution. We'll just focus on continuously creating more and more fresh stories and using data and technology to determine which ones have heat. That's what the future will bring.
And that was David Lee, Chief Financial Officer, Chief Operating Officer for Webtoon Entertainment. Let's now talk to Kerry Leahy, economist at the University of Columbia. Kerry, thanks for being with us. Well, first of all, Webtoon, quite a big IPO, one of the biggest recent ones on the NASDAQ. How did it do?
It did very well. As you know, there are famous stocks like Facebook that stumbled in their initial public offering. And this, the bankers did their job correctly, and the stock price went up about $3 a share from the initial offering of $21 a share. So it was actually a very good day. Investors are happy at the end of the day that they have a price at the end of the day that's considerably higher than the one they bought at the beginning of the day.
Now, looking more widely, Kerry, we've got some interesting data coming out in the next 24 hours or so. The PCE price data. Now, this is really important because it's actually a real benchmark for example, the Fed, isn't it?
Yes, it's their preferred inflation measure, and it does spin off the CPI. And for the moment, the gap between what that's telling us and what the CPI is telling us is relatively wide. But the market has a pretty good sense of what that number is going to look like. And it is not as low as the Fed would like, meaning the so-called 2% benchmark. But it is a very important figure. And as the Fed has said, since we don't know where we're going, we're going to let the data tell us where we're going. Each little bit morsel of data perhaps gives you a better idea of what the Fed's going to do. And the Fed has promised us some rate cuts, just a question of when.
We will see, and we will review that data when it comes out. Kerry, thanks so much for being with us. Kerry Leahy there.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, India's government has asked for a report from the Tamil Nadu authorities after a Reuters investigation alleged that iPhone maker Foxconn had excluded married women from jobs at its main India iPhone plant near Chennai. Reuters reported that Foxconn managers suggested such women had greater family responsibilities compared to unmarried women and as a reason for not hiring them. Foxconn, for their part, deny there is discrimination in hiring. I spoke earlier to Rohit Lamba, an economics professor focused on India at Penn State University in the US, and I asked him about the backdrop to these sort of allegations.
This issue should be laid in the broader context of what is currently India's female labor force participation, which is very, very low. You know, one data set suggests around 10%, another set suggests around 20%. To put it in context, at the peak of its manufacturing juggernaut, the female labor force participation in China was to the tune of 80%. So, India is actually facing a big problem that for the level of its growth, the female labor force participation has not gone up. So in that backdrop, given that Foxconn is actually employing a lot of women, so most estimates suggest that around 70% of their workforce is women. By employing women in very large numbers, there seems to be some discrimination at the intensive margin on restrictions of what women they're hiring.
Okay, so you're saying that they are a big employer of women, have been, and I suppose one could say that their arrival in India, the push towards iPhone manufacture there, could actually improve the employment of women more generally.
One has to be careful, right? Because just because, you know, they're employing women doesn't mean that they're employing them under the right conditions and so on. But what I'm trying to argue is one must put this in the context that, yes, as more and more such kind of jobs come to India, whether they are in phones or other forms of low-skill manufacturing, you know, it will offer an opportunity for women re-employed in larger numbers, which is an Achilles heel of the Indian growth story.
And Foxconn coming to India is obviously a big thing, a very welcome thing for the Indian economy generally. Do you think perhaps there's been a bit of people perhaps turning a blind eye to these kind of practices to encourage companies like Foxconn to get into the Indian economy?
So Raghuram Rajan, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, and I have written a book because we have been quite critical of certain kinds of subsidies and SOPs being given to companies like Foxconn, because it's not clear whether they won't come to India in the first place for geopolitical reasons. So India today is giving around 6% subsidy per iPhone to Foxconn. So we're in a very interesting situation where Apple, which is one of the richest companies in the world, is getting a 6% subsidy per phone being manufactured from a relatively low-income country. And Foxconn, there might be a temptation to look the other way because it has actually been one of the few success stories of this kind of renewed industrial policy push to bring low-skill manufacturing jobs to India.
Do you think that the fact the government has responded, perhaps in a fairly neutral way, they've asked for a report, does that suggests that in this case, perhaps they're trying not to scare Foxconn away?
Now, the government has to balance this issue in a reasonable way, which is to ensure that it does send a signal to companies that they are open for business, that India is open for business, and especially when it comes to measures to increase female labor force participation. So one of the things that this, you know, Foxconn has done is to build dorms for women to take the issues of safety out, because safety has always been an issue, especially in urban commutes, to get a higher number of female labor force participation. And I think they've done a reasonable job so far in responding immediately to the concern and to saying, no, we're looking into this. This is not our policy. And Foxconn has also responded immediately. And I would like to also request international media to report on this in a responsible way. And I did think that the Reuters report was a little alarmist, that it didn't put the whole kind of report in the context of India's jobs crisis, in the context of low female labor force participation. This is not to suggest that obviously there should be no discrimination on the basis of marital status for hiring women, but I think it should also have been reported that this company, and that in general there is a push by government policy to increase the level of female labor force participation in the country, especially in the sector of low-skill manufacturing.
Rohit Lamba there. Now, in the next few hours in Atlanta, Georgia, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump are set to square off in the first debate of this year's presidential election. Georgia could be key to the outcome of the vote in November. Biden will spotlight his economic agenda, a big part of which has been using government investment to create new manufacturing jobs. However, as Michel Fleury reports, job creation isn't necessarily winning over voters.
Right now, I'm standing in the hub of Qcells solar panel making operation. Now, when I walked in, I could barely see the other end of the room. It's a sort of huge hangar. Everywhere I look, automation is king, as you can hear from the noise around me. The operation is massive. It reflects the sheer scale of investment by both the government and foreign companies to create green energy jobs of the future here in America.
Thanks to the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA as it's known, wafers mainly made in China will soon be made in America. I spoke to Scott Moskowitz, who leads Qcells' US policy and market strategy.
Our industry needs more of these investments. We're currently the only facility that's going to be making cells and wafers, and that's what Qcells is building in Cartersville. But that's the only such facility like it that's under construction in the United States. So the IRA has been really successful at generating new investment, but our industry needs a lot more investment.
So you think without it, it would have taken longer to get to this point?
Or it might not have happened at all.
President Biden boasts his approach has created nearly 800,000 manufacturing jobs, something Alan Rodriguez and Wayne Locke, workers at Qcells, say they're grateful for.
The company has given me a great opportunity to start from a very entry level to move to a engineering spot, which for me, you know, is something that I'm thankful for.
We're also one of the largest facilities in the Western Hemisphere, and that's something they can be proud of. It's like, oh, we have this here where most people don't anywhere else in the United States.
But while Qcells jobs may be green, this district is deep red. Dalton is in Donald Trump country, home to Marjorie Taylor Greene, in one of the most bitterly contested states in this year's election. Democrats hope that by creating clean energy jobs here, they may create more Biden voters come November. Here's what they used to make in Dalton. Carpet. They're just cutting up the carpets into regular squares the size of a doormat. One of the small carpet firms in town belongs to Jan Pourquoi, a Democrat.
Nobody cares about clean energy, not around here. That is the type of stuff that I would call the latte liberals care about in the big city when they're sipping on their Starbucks coffee.
He doesn't think the Inflation Reduction Act will do much for Joe Biden's re-election chances, not in Dalton.
In the business community, there is a resentment against that company because they got breaks from the government, leaving the local guys wondering whether the government yet again is picking winners and losers.
Pancake, banana pancake.
At the Oakwood Cafe in Dalton, the food is hearty, the conversation flows, but you won't hear much talk of green jobs.
Who had the omelette? Hash browns?
Owner Casey Carpenter, who is the local Republican representative, explains why his party doesn't like the Democrats' economic strategy.
Getting a little bit of bacon aching there. Probably the Republican turnoff has always been it's kind of shoved down their throat with subsidies instead of letting it naturally evolve. For years, Republicans have, you know, been against solar panels, but I think there's a place for it. I think diversification and energy independence, those things are Republican words.
The Biden administration is pouring billions into red districts in the hopes of ensuring a green and prosperous future is made in America. The presidential debate is an opportunity for him to claim credit. So far, it's not clear he will reap the benefit come November.
Michelle Fleury reporting there from Georgia. So what is it that those involved in the economy really want to hear from Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden in this upcoming debate? Well, joining me now, I'm very pleased to say, is Tracy Tapani, owner of Wyoming Machine, based in Minnesota, and vice chair of the Small Business Council there. Tracy, thank you so much for being with us. Now, you own a manufacturing company in Wyoming. As I said, you had 4 years under President Trump, 4 years under President Biden. Is one better than the other when it comes to a small business ownership?
You know, I think that there have been benefits under both of those administrations. Under the Trump administration, we saw the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which brought some tax relief to business owners. And I think the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, along with the CHIPS Act under the Biden administration, have great potential to help grow and build the U.S. manufacturing economy.
Now, there's an issue, I gather, around tax liabilities that could hugely affect small businesses like yours next year. I mean, just tell us what that's about and whether either party is addressing it.
So there are some tax cuts that were passed during the Trump presidency, as I already mentioned, that are set to expire at the end of 2025. And some of those could have a significant impact on small businesses. So, for example, there's a 20% pass-through deduction that impacts businesses like partnerships and sole proprietorships. There's R&D tax credits potentially at stake. And, you know, you can imagine tax credits for research and development are necessary in the manufacturing industry as we grow and innovate what we're doing. Both of those are at risk. And I think small business owners are very concerned that we're going to get to the end of 2025 and be hanging at the edge of this so-called tax cliff. Not knowing if we're going to be paying more taxes, less taxes, the same taxes, making it almost impossible to plan for capital expenditures and growth and expansions in our businesses.
Now, I should explain that your Wyoming Machine, your company, sheet metal fabrication company, you make parts for, I think, Fortune 500 companies and small companies. I mean, that's an area, I guess, where there could be a threat from Chinese imports. And China does come up a lot in conversation. Do you approve of tariffs on Chinese manufactured goods? Does that actually help protect American business?
You know, I think I'm going to tell you that I think that that is a very complicated topic. And I think that what small business owners and business in general would want is for the United States government to continue to pursue free trade throughout the world while protecting our security. If we can't trade freely with other countries in the world, it affects all of us and every kind of business is impacted by that. So we're really looking for continued open discussions about trade policy that creates fair, open, and predictable markets all around the world.
Now, Tracy, you've been running a pretty successful business, I think operating about 50 years. Are you going to run that organization, I don't know, into your old age? Is it important for you thinking about that kind of longevity when you're thinking about who you're going to vote for?
It is important to me because when you have a long legacy in business, and mine is a family business that was started by my father, I would like to see our business continue long into the future. I think small business in America is a backbone of our economy. And, you know, sometimes when people refer to us as small, they're not really taking the full picture into effect.
You're small, but very important inside the economy itself. I think that's really the point, is it? Tracy, thank you so much for being with us. Tracy Tapani there talking to me and looking ahead to some of what we might hear from, of course, the debate that's coming up a bit later. We'll be covering that, certainly the run-up to it in Business Matters, if you can listen later on. But that's it now from World Business Report.
Hold up.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Any forward progress in technology involves some rational assumption of risk. And the way Google is thinking about that is, okay, how do we proceed both boldly and responsibly? Because the promise of these technologies is just so overwhelming.
Google's chief privacy officer, Keith Enright, talking about their approach to AI and privacy.
Take On Tomorrow from PwC's Strategy and Business. Available wherever you get your podcasts.